Welcome to Universal Talk. Tonight we have a very special show for you guys. The title of the show is The Geosocial, Societal, Economic, Political, and Spiritual Impact of Open ET Contact. We have a very special lineup of guests for you guys. And the lineup tonight is this: astronaut Edgar Mitchell, Simon Parks, Alfred Weber, Jim Delatoso, and Tolik. And I'll just go down through each individual person's bio for you guys, just in case you happen to not know one of these guys. Obviously, we all know who astronaut Edgar Mitchell is. Dr. Mitchell was an Apollo 14 astronaut and the sixth man to walk on the moon. He is also the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS. Dr. Mitchell firmly believes we are not alone in the universe and that we have been visited by intelligent alien life. To these facts, he made a formal disclosure at a press conference held on April 20th, 2009 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and in 2013 to the U.S. Congress, confirming the reality and existence of UFOs and extraterrestrial life. His website is www.edmitchellapollo14.com and www.noetic.org. Next in our lineup, we have Simon Parks. He is a United Kingdom Labour councillor who was essentially raised by extraterrestrials, has had continued contact and communications, and visits with mantids, essentially an intelligent extra-dimensional race of praying mantis beings aboard their ships, and who has family blood lineage to what is known as the Illuminati, but who has instead chosen to live a life of service and light to humanity. Next, we have Alfred Weber. Alfred is a futurist, attorney, international tribunal judge, and author of the recent book, The Dimensional Ecology of the Omniverse. The book reveals new scientific evidence on matters such as the afterlife, the human soul, reincarnation, and God, where Weber details evidence in souls and God in the spiritual dimensions in co-creating the universes of the multiverse, and that each of our souls is a holographic fragment of God, the Source. He is also the author of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. His website is www.exopolitics.com. And next we have Jim Delatosa, or JD. He is an engineer in audio-video signal processing and image analysis. His applications have included music and visual production for groups such as the Moody Blues, NASA JPL Voyager Project, and supercomputers applications for CAD, bioscience, and avionics. He has investigated many hundreds of photographs of UFOs using rigorous, highly scientific, analytical methods. Visible work includes the Billy Myers Pleiades case with Wendell Stevens, the APRO case files, and the Phoenix Lights. His interest in UFO photo analysis led to deeper technical analysis using data mining techniques to catalog important clusters of data from contactees to military intelligence, UFO flight characteristics, to alien behavior theory. Today, Jim Delatoso works in development of molecular modeling for agriculture, microbiology, genomic, and hyperspectral imaging on remote-controlled aircraft. Next, we have Tolik. Tolik is a human representative of the Andromeda Council, an intergalactic, interstellar, and interdimensional governance and development body of aligned, benevolent star systems and planets for worlds in both the Milky Way and Andromeda galaxies. There are 12 star systems and their home worlds that make up the senior members of the Council. Tolik's first physical contact with them happened at age 5, with additional contact at ages 8, 12, 15, and 18. Again, in life at age 35 in the summer of 1993 when he took a trip back in time to the 1840s in rural America with the commander of the Primary Andromeda Council, Biosphere. His Andromeda Council friends tell him his total time off planet Earth for various training he's received, calculated based on Earth time, would total to approximately 100 years. His ongoing contact continues today in the form of telepathy and both moving and still images. His website is www.andromedacouncil.com.
Okay, and so Dr. Mitchell, you're recognized as being the sixth man on the moon, and you're also the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS. And so, with this in mind, this the geosocial, societal, economic, political, and spiritual impact of open contact, ET contact, what is your take on that? How do you feel like this information or open ET contact will affect the population?
Well, I'm hoping, from a scientist's point of view, the purpose was to bring the study and understanding of consciousness into the world of science. That's what I set out to do when I formed Noetics after I got back on the 42 years ago. And I think we've made a dent in that process. I don't think it is complete by any means. And I think we're understanding now that the universe that we observe is far more complex than we ever thought back in those days. And we thought it was complex then, but it's even more complex than we ever thought.
Right. And so you come out formally with the disclosure at a press conference held April 20th, which happens to be my birthday. And 2009 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. So formally, this is already, you've already testified for this. And so you believe that there are extraterrestrial or star family beings. How would you describe this to the public today, in today's world?
The first statement would be to think that we're alone in our universe is utter nonsense. The evidence for having been visited recently and even in ancient times is to me very compelling and been well established. Now, many people still do not accept that, but I'm sorry for them. I think they're missing out.
Right. And so I know the next question that all the listeners are just, they're just probably saying, ask the question. And the question would be this, like, while you were out in space and you were on the moon, was there anything that you saw that wasn't typical with all the training that you have? And you have a doctorate, you're an astronaut, and, you know, with all of your experience, and have you witnessed anything then or at any other time in your life on this planet that would suggest or prove to you that we're definitely not alone, not just the scientific facts, or well, not facts, but the...
You not know, on
statistics.
Not on my trip to the moon. No. However, I did grow up in near Roswell, New Mexico, which was the site of the 1947 crash near Roswell, and
right.
I have talked to many of the folks and the descendants of the folks that were associated with that crash, including the I think it's the grandson of the undertaker who provided coffins for the deceased aliens. Also, we had a family friend who was a office mate or near office mate right down the hall from what was his name? I'm blocking the major who went to the site and brought the evidence back and. Then also there was a sheriff's deputy, the descendant of a sheriff's deputy, that managed the traffic around the crash site, and he testified to me that that's what his family had told him, So although I didn't have personal experience, I certainly had testimony from a lot of people who had personal experience.
Absolutely. Okay, great. And so we have several people on the panel, so thank you for that. And we're just going to try to get this flow going here, and I'm going to ask Simon Parks. You're coming from the UK, and maybe you could give us some insight on your perspective on this, what the impact of open ET contact what do you suspect will happen, and how would it change the world, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I want to honor Edgar, because it's incredible for somebody who has come from his background and achieved what he's achieved to speak so openly. Although I think Edgar could speak more openly if things were different. The main topic of this very interesting panel, for me, really revolves around a split in the elite governments, half of which wish to tell the truth to the public and half of which do not. And we see that playing out around us in a greater and greater game. And I honestly think that there has to be some sort of anonymity to allow people who up until now have played a very dangerous game and played on the wrong side of the game, to allow them to come over and be accepted without any form of congressional hearings or any form of court cases. So I think that for me, the important part is the elite and the human governments coming to terms with what they need to do. Until such time as that happens, the only other alternative for benevolent alien races is to actually circumvent the American government and the other two major governments on the planet now and just show themselves over every city. And that is a threat that they've made because time is running out. So, for me, it's about getting the governments on board and then trying to work with them rather than excluding them.
Sure. And so one last question before we move on to the next guest is, when you mention time is running out, I'm sure the listeners are going to be like, okay, what does he mean by that?
Well, the date that I'm absolutely clear on is 2016, because if humanity can hold it together by 2016, which is very close now, I think that the timeline that we're currently on will be solidified, and it's going to be a very good outcome. I think that the next 2 years, we'll see some pretty exciting stuff. So 2016.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and so I could ask so many questions, but again, I'm trying to give equal time to everybody. So we're going to move on to Alfred. And again, thank you all for coming on. But Alfred, what do you think the impact of open ET contact would be to our population?
Well, yeah, well, thank you. In that entire line of the title, I'd like to just concentrate in my brief remarks on open ET contact. And one researcher that I know, just to segue from what Simon just said, Australian researcher Mary Rodwell, she specializes in interviewing the crystal kids who go up into the ships at night and are briefed by the and downloaded by the ETs in the ships, and then come down, and then they download to her, and they tell the kids that in 2017, 1 year after 2016, there's going to be a great transformation of consciousness on the planet. And I think that will be the key to ET contact, because we are in the dimension based typology of intelligent civilizations. We're a third density a third density solar system civilization, which means that it's our consciousness that's kind of holding us back. Our big dimension is time, and some of us are on this planet at 3.1, others at 3.8, and you know, we really need to expand our consciousness. Just very briefly, some figures. Two scientists at Princeton finally got a good estimate in their scientific paper on the number of universes in the multiverse. And if you, it's a number that they call humongous. That is, the human mind cannot comprehend it. And if you go to write it out using 12-point type in a computer, that number would stretch for 260 million miles. That's how many universes there are in the multiverse. And the latest German estimate of the number of galaxies in our particular universe is 500 billion galaxies. Now, the most conservative estimate, this is from the Drake equation, of intelligent civilizations, and that's extremely conservative, is 12 communicating intelligent civilizations per galaxy. I mean, that is extremely conservative. So that the most conservative estimate that we have of intelligent communicating civilizations in our universe alone by the Drake equation is 500 billion, because there are 500 billion galaxies in our universe by the current science. So that gives you what the current science says in terms of estimated universes and estimated number of intelligent civilizations. Now, because of our third density civilization, and because sort of the Star Wars background of our planet, we have been in what we can call a quarantine, which is why our culture, our civilization, really doesn't know that much about the outside world. But that's changing. And so I would say, well, has there been outside ET contact? And I would say yes. And the case that I point to is one that, as an exopolitical person, people can go to exopolitics.com and look at it very closely. We studied very, very closely. I did interviews with him and Canadian ufologists studied, and that's with a colleague of mine, lifelong NORAD officer Stanley Fulham, who wrote a book. He was with NORAD. His job was to, at NORAD, his job was to send the fighters out to intercept any UFO that intruded into North American airspace. So he knew UFOs upside and downside. When he left NORAD, the Regional Galactic Governance Council of this area, and you know, in the dimension-based typology of intelligent civilizations, you have third density time-space civilizations, of which we're one. You have hyperdimensional civilizations like the ETs and upper-dimensional human civilizations and all sorts of exophenotypologies. And then you have intelligent civilizations governance authorities. Well, the local regional galactic governance council, which are the Pleiadians, Alpha Centaurians, the Syrians, and others, contacted him. And they said, look, we're going to, because you have all this background, we're going to tell you what our plans are. And he wrote a book, which he published. And on the book, he said, and the Galactic Governance Council is going to show themselves over New York City on October 13, 2010. And I thought he was crazy. I said, Stanley, how can you do that? Well, he published his book. And on October 13, 2010, the Pleiadian fleet showed itself over New York City, and it was duly photographed. And we have all the photographs there. And it was very synchronous, because on October 11th, the UN Outer Space Committee met inside the UN. I've been liaising with them for years, because I was a UN NGO representative in this area for many, many years. They held their first committee meeting on the extraterrestrial presence the next day. So this was all coordinated. And the ET Council said, we chose New York because they're a cosmopolitan, blasé, and sophisticated city. And you can go to exopolitics.com and see all of the background there, the interviews, etc. Now, Stanley Fullam was given a fast-acting cancer, and he died in December. The Paris had to kill all these people. So we have had ET contact, and it's like Simon said, there's this war between half of the governments that want OpenT contact. There's a group, mainly monarchy-based and banker-based, that don't want it. And my contention, and this is my closing remark, people can go to positivefuture.info and see the equation. Positive future equals positive timeline plus unity consciousness. Objectively, we are now in a positive timeline, and that means that the timeline itself, the architecture of nature and of time, is such that we are going to have open contact and we have a positive future. So those are my remarks.
And thank you so much for that, Alfred. To dovetail that in, you were mentioning the last thing you said as far as a specific being were the Pleiadians. And so to dovetail with that, Jim De La Tosa, or JD, what can you bring in relation to what Alfred just said, or just some thoughts of your own about the Pleiadians that you've studied over the years?
Yes, the first exposure I had to the Pleiadians was in my second generation of testing UFO photographs, the first being the 40 from APRO in Tucson. And then the second group was brought to me by Wendell Stevens, and were four pictures from the case he was working on in Switzerland, the Billy Meyer case. So we had been developing for about a year a forensic-driven process for examination of photographs. And that involved a number of other people, about a half a dozen that were each at their own kind of lab, their own specialty lab. And we found no evidence of a hoax. And of course, it was all very interesting, very, very interesting, because here were some very clear pictures of extraterrestrial spacecraft, or a very advanced spacecraft made by humans. And once the analysis of the photographs was completed, of course, I remained with the group in the investigation of the case. And the claims of Billy Meyer that he was in contact with a group of extraterrestrials that looked like us, that have been here for a very long time, thousands of years. And as it was explained, it made sense that dogs and cats' ages are measured in human years. Well, a dog is 1 year equals seven, for example. So the idea that extraterrestrials could live much longer was okay with me. But who were they? Why were they here? And what was their relationship to us became actually more important to me right off than just testing the photographs. But I did remain involved deeply in photometric analysis for decades to this day. And along the way, the idea of the Pleiades being in contact with Earth became almost ubiquitous. Number of people started channeling the Pleiades. A number of people were even using the Pleiadian beam ship Type 3 as the logo in their letterhead and their business cards. And there was a transfer of consciousness that had happened, even with the very mean-spirited naysayers that were against not just the Meyer case, but most contact cases, that there was a transfer, an idea had happened, that there were extraterrestrials that looked like us, that were in communication with some people for reasons of bettering the human species versus the idea that the extraterrestrials are here for their own purposes, or they're going to cook us and eat us later, or take us over, whatever the radical views might be. So I never really became, let's say, a promoter, an advocate of the Meyer case. I was very involved with it, but my mission was to analyze the photographs, not to pick up the baton of any case where I found it to be no evidence of a hoax and become the proponent of that case. Likewise, when I would find something that was a mistake or even a hoax, it was not my assigned role to expose that hoaxer. Might put it in one report once. So I was able to remain kind of neutral to any particular one extraterrestrial visitor case or concept and look at it all. From my interest, my point of view was analyzing the photographs gives us one set of understanding about the patterns of the crash. But if we go up into a skyscraper, photograph all the cars driving around down below, and then analyze them all to know whether they're a Ford or a Hummer, do we know anything about the people driving the cars? No. And should not we be talking to people who have had contact with the people driving the cars and the contactees, the abductees, the contactees, and get further information and understanding there? Because even out of 1,000, if 900 made a mistake and 50 are delusional and 48 made it up, it only takes one person who actually had contact with extraterrestrials to give us a deeper, much deeper understanding of who they are and why they're here. Unless they're all here for different reasons, or unless there's even a larger intelligence bubble that's wrapped around that, such as a prime directive. And that really became my database. Developed a hypothesis, and as the evidence came to me to be analyzed, and sometimes it was soil samples, occasionally it was some alleged metal samples, voice stress analysis, psychological stress evaluation of witnesses, that the information coming through would be applied to the hypothesis that I had created, or the choices, a matrix of hypotheses, to see which one was probably more true. And the one that started to become probably more true was that the extraterrestrials are policed if they come here. They probably do, but in the hypothesis, an if, that there would probably be a group like, let's say, the Pleiades, that police the incoming extraterrestrials who have come to study and analyze us poor little humans who have run amok with our technology, and try to understand for their own development what happens when a species is given free will, creativity, intellect, the potential for spiritual development in one lifetime. We could go from a pimp to, not that being a pimp's all that bad, let's say a pimp to an avatar in one lifetime. And it became apparent to me that there is not a government cover-up. It's an extraterrestrial cover-up. If the extraterrestrials did not want there to be a cover-up, there wouldn't be one. And if we had had disclosure, worldwide disclosure, that extraterrestrials are here and have been coming here, would the extraterrestrials just show up the following day? What if they didn't? And the latitudes that we have in developing ourselves as humans, far more robust arena to play in than the one issue of whether extraterrestrials come here and apparently are hiding. We'll talk a little bit later about what I think they are really here for, what they're up to. But from my point of view of testing pictures and being associated with a case that had evidence and supporting the claim, contact with extraterrestrials from the Pleiades, the term Pleiades from Greek mythology, and it's the same constellation as Hathor to the Egyptians and Subaru in the Orient, all pointing in the Dogon tribe, all pointing to that same cluster of stars, saying, we got our information, we got our help. People came from right there. So hopefully I answered your question. I hope I didn't ask and answer my own question, but the framework from which I continued my work to this day in examination of evidence and a lot of interviews, discussions with contactees, is related to why they are coming here. More important to me to know than if they are coming here. We're kind of all past that, I believe.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, you know, thank you for that. That's, I was just thinking, I'm like, there's nobody on this call that is even questioning whether they're here or not, and they've been here forever. And so it's still interesting to me as we're talking that there's some people, many people, that don't even believe of the existence. And so I guess it's really important to get all these perspectives, and so thank you for that. And I'm going to bring in Tolik, last but not least, of course. Welcome, Tolik. What is your take? What is the Andromedan Council saying of all this? And what do you think the impact of this open DT contact would be to our population? And it doesn't seem like it's going to be an if, it's going to be a when, from what everybody on this panel so far has been talking about.
I think that's accurate. There are, if this is a puzzle, there are so many puzzle pieces that metaphorically will come together and paint the complete picture. I'm fully cognizant of the fact that we're not going to bring together all the answers in this 2+ hour panel discussion, but hopefully that we'll each address some issues none of us have thought of before, and maybe raise some more questions. What I'd like to do is touch on parts of things that I've learned in discussion with JD, whom you have known quite well over the years, Wendell Stevens, with Bob Dean and others, including my own experiences. As an example, I was sitting with Wendell during the mid-90s at a conference, and I was still relatively young in those days in terms of my own experiences. And I said, Wendell, with all of the research you've done and the books, the multiple books that you've written about contactees' experiences, either with organic extraterrestrials visiting this planet or people that have gone to other worlds, what does your knowledge base tell you, Wendell? How many people, how many races do you think are visiting this planet at this time? Mid-90s, he said, about 125. And that's only organic 3D races. Now I'll provide a comparison and fast forward to the future. In a conversation with my primary contact, who's the commander of the primary Andromeda Council biosphere, in a conversation with him, I don't know, in the past year and a half or so, I said, well, there's a lot going on, not only with the changes that are happening within the context of the solar system, but within the context of this planet. Can you tell me approximately how many races are observing the changes on this planet and are anticipating a far greater change? And his answer was approximately 500 races plus, both 3D organic as well as higher dimensional. Now I'll talk about a topic that we've all heard a few times, that Bob Deenan telling his own story. And I'll paraphrase him. Bob said, at that time, and he's talking about his experiences with SHAPE and NATO, right after World War II, he said, the generals and the admirals, we knew about at least four races, maybe five. And then again, this is Bob Dean's story. And one of those races looked so much like us that if we walked into a Howard Johnson's or McDonald's, we couldn't tell them apart. They are human. They may not be Earth human, but they're human. Now I'm going to tie this in with an experience I had just last year. I attended a conference in October. I wasn't a speaker, I just attended. And there was a gentleman who you might think would be of mixed race, some Caucasian, some African American, and a few other parts. And to make a long story short, I found out that this particular gentleman was from, well, his place of origin. Now, I don't know where his body was from, but his place of origin was from Arcturus. And he was observing and listening to all of the speakers and the stories that were being told. And we chatted later. It was a fascinating experience. So I tell both my own experiences and anecdotal to show that we are not alone in our experiences. Dr. Mitchell, I would imagine that in your own space flight, you gentlemen saw some craft that were probably not from this planet.
Well, if you're asking me, I did not, nor did any of us on our flight. And if others did, they certainly didn't make it known.
Ah, okay. I do know that certainly where I live in the desert southwest, just in terms of craft alone, there are many craft in the nighttime sky that don't look like what our people are flying. You know, they don't have fixed wings. They don't move the same way. To bring this to up to date and to make it germane to this planet and why this planet is important, I'll go back to another conversation I had with Wendell, also in the mid-90s. And I said to him, Wendell, why this planet? What makes it so special? And Simon, I think this is going to tie into something that you said within the past 8 months or a year, one of your discussions.
Okay.
Again, I'll paraphrase Wendell. And he said, this planet is unique. Even though it's on the outskirts of this particular galaxy, it is unique because it has a lot of water and it has an enormous amount of species. He said it's probably the greatest, it's probably the planet of the greatest diversity in this galaxy. And he said, moreover, I'm not really sure that it was supposed to evolve the way it has. It was probably more likely supposed to be a repository, a genetic repository of species that races throughout the universe, the known universe, the galaxies, could come to collect genetic samples if they needed some, in case certain ones of theirs were expiring, were going away. He said, absolutely. He said, you know, if you just look at the variety of insects alone and go up the chain, you know, insects, birds, animals, fish, humans, and we have, just to look at humans alone, we probably have four or five species of humans on this planet that have come from different places. As an example, based on my own knowledge of what I've learned about where my soul essence was birthed. My soul essence was birthed on the planet Dakote, which is one of four planets in the open star cluster of the Pleiades, but of the sun, Tegeta. That particular star is Tegeta. Four planets, Pyra, Vela, Dakotay, and the other one is the place where Semyasi is supposed to be from. Begins with an E. So I can tell you about things that I have learned about migration of the people from the planet Dakotay to this world. Humans that migrated from Dakotay many, many years ago. And today those people are the great, 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 if you will, grandchildren of the people of Dakotay. They are the Lakota, Dakota, Apache, Comanche, almost all the native people from the North American continent. So I have knowledge, I have some empirical evidence, I have anecdotal stories that people have shared with me that tell me this is a very, very unique planet. The other thing that makes it unique is based on the way that the core of this planet transformed in December of 2012. My Andromeda Council contacts have told me it's the first time that a planet has undergone an energetic change. They have said the core of the Earth used to be blue plasma. And it has evolved into a new kind of substance that they call SAR. And there's a little bit of a sense of humor there because they use the word SAR because it's not quite a star, but on the way there, which means the vibrational frequency, the vibrational rate of this planet is rising. I'm going to quote another source, and I wish I had saved the article. About a year and a half, 2 years ago, I saw an article that came out of Russia regarding some scientific research that had been done. And these Russian scientists indicated that not only is the planet Earth warming and rising in vibration, but they have measured the rise in magnetic rate, frequency, vibration, and luminosity of all of the planets in this star system. I can't make any claims about Pluto, but they were saying this whole solar system is going through a rise in frequency, a rise in vibration. It is changing. And that's been the bulk of my knowledge, the bulk of my experience that they've taught me about. If you combine the fact that people are awakening, that consciousness is rising in people, I think it remains to be seen how a global populace will handle this subject. We have a hard time. And I don't mean individual people, but I think as a global society, people have a difficult time sometimes interacting with, living with people that are vastly different from them, their mores, their values, certainly religion. And I'm not making any statements that nobody's surprised at, but if we have a difficult enough time on this planet drawing boundary lines between countries, how are we as a global people going to accept the reality of people from another world who may yet have other completely different societal values, and maybe they worship a completely different deity? And I'm not providing answers, I'm providing questions. All these questions are going to be up on the table. Well, where are they from? How do they think? How do they feel? It remains to be seen how many people will be open to this concept. And like I said, right now I'm not providing a lot of answers. I'm asking questions more than anything else, but I'll open the floor back up. And if anybody wants to provide feedback to what I just said, feel free.
Okay, and so I guess just to go with the flow here, I'm going to bring back in Dr. Mitchell here just to keep this flow going, and then I guess we can just break into responding to one another. But I'm curious to know, Dr. Mitchell, with all of your experience and your education in regards to being an astronaut and the technology that that you were aware of, whether you saw anything personally yourself flying through the sky, or you've seen pictures or images or testimonies, what is your take on that? Like, do we now, or did we at the time that you were an astronaut, did we have that kind of technology that that these craft could go through the sky and make these right angle turns at the speeds that you know the testimonies are saying or witnessing?
Not that I'm aware of. A lot of rumors, a lot of speculation, a lot of stories like we just heard from Jim, but nothing that good science could validate.
Could I possibly come in? Would that be okay?
Sure.
I want to help Edgar a little bit here. My mother worked for British Security, but she was actually working for the National Security Agency of America. My grandfather worked for British Security, but he was actually working for the CIA. It's very difficult for somebody like Edgar, if he's asked direct questions like that on an open channel. Edgar is a very, very well-known figure, and I think it would probably be helpful not to ask Edgar direct questions. Edgar, would that be helpful?
Gentlemen, I have run out of time. I have another important engagement very shortly, and I can't spend any more time on this today. But I'm vitally interested in the subject. I'm vitally interested in what we can learn. But what Jim was just saying a little while ago in his testimony is far beyond anything I've experienced.
Yeah, my grandfather was very much the same, Edgar. When he was in public, he found it quite difficult. But when he was in private and it was a secure environment, then he was more open. And I do think that what you do is marvelous. You've headed up an organization. You've put your name to it. And I guess that's probably as far as you can go. So I personally actually want to say I think you've been very brave, and I appreciate what you've done. I'm not a researcher, Edgar. I have actually experienced creatures from other worlds, probably the fourth dimension. I don't call them ETs, I call them extra-dimensional entities because they come through a portal. They certainly work with the major governments of the world. I'm absolutely familiar with that, not from reading it in a book, but from actually having experience of that. I am very hopeful that what Tolek has said is true in terms of the energetic change and the energetic shift, which took place on the 21st of December 2012. And from my own position as a politician, I get figures that relate not just to Great Britain, but to every country in the world. And since the 21st of December 2012, crime has fallen in every country on the globe, every country. Wow. And what we're seeing is the bad people are getting worse and the good people are getting better. So the violent crimes are actually increasing, but general crime overall is reducing. And this is because the vast majority of humanity has taken the choice to move towards a path of betterment. So it's a fundamental proof that something very important happened at the end of 2012. So I think that's probably all I want to say at the moment.
And you know what? Thank you so much for that. I want to excuse Dr. Mitchell here because he has to go. He has a prior engagement. And again, if you guys all want to chime in here, and thank you for your contribution, Dr. Mitchell.
Yes, thank you very much.
Good luck to all of you.
Thank you.
Okay, and with that, Alfred, would you like to follow up on Simon's discussion there of His personal experiences that he just spoke of, he talked about the CIA. As a lawyer, you're privy to some of the information that not a lot of people on the planet are because of the different contacts you've made over the years. And so some of the things that we kind of tell off camera or off the air, is there anything that you've heard that you haven't ever told anybody that you'd feel comfortable talking about today, or are you just flat out open, you just tell whatever information you get, you bring out to the world?
Well, I've never been part of a secret organization. So what I thought you were going to ask me was, could I follow up on what Simon just said, which was, I mean, that's amazing data that he just shared in terms of the positive timeline, because I just released a paper on that, and I would love to share that paper if I could.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, because I really don't. I my beat is transparency, and I've been I call it public interest counterintelligence, and I've been in this field for 40 years, and my thing is to make everything public. So, and it's not things that I know, it's things that I find out and make public.
Awesome.
Yeah. So what Simon says is actually quite true. And people can go to positivefuture.info, and I actually have been tracking this since 1973, when I wrote a book called, which was the first book that integrated modern earth sciences with parapsychology and psychic capacity and the ability of the humans to look into that non-local realm and see past and future events. And it integrated some of the Edgar Cayce prophecies, which at that time he had sort of a what I would call a psychic remote viewing experience, where he saw this global coastal event happening, which Japan sank and all the coasts happened, and the, you know, and the human population was devastated, and that was early in the 21st century. Now you fast forward this to 1971, and in the secret DARPA CIA time travel program called Project Pegasus, where a colleague of mine, Andrew D. Bishago, was a child participant. He was sent, he was part of a one-time probe in 1971, a chronovisor probe that went to the Washington, D.C. in 2013 and found the U.S. Supreme Court building under 100 feet of brackish water. And the way that that would have happened is that there was a global coastal event, such as the one that Edgar Cayce found in 2013. And the defense attaché that in charge of that program was Donald H. Rumsfeld. And the national security advisor was Henry Kissinger. And the president at that time was Richard Nixon, and there was an executive decision taken at that time which resulted into $2 or $3 trillion devoted to building a whole worldwide network of deep underground military bases, DUMs. And it was a dumb program in some ways, because of this coming coastal event. It could have been, oh, Nibiru, oh, Planet X. We don't know what the cause could have been, but it gave rise to an industry in many different channels. Then we had another study, another colleague of mine, Dr. Courtney Brown at the Farsight Institute in 2010, he put together the largest remote viewing study of military trained remote viewers in history who thought they were just going to look for what's the impact of global warming in 2013. Instead, they found a global coastal event in June 2013, which included the U.S. Capitol building under water, which was a correlation to the 1971 DARPA forward time travel study that found the U.S. Supreme Court building is right across the street from the Capitol building under 100 feet of brackish water. So here you have three different studies, including the CASEY, converging on June 2013 or 2013 or the first quarter of the 21st century, having this global coastal event, and then all these governmental entities, following suit, $2 to $3 trillion in deep underground military bases in Norway. All of the Bilderbergers build these seed banks. There's underground bases in Norway for all the political and financial and monarchical elite. And, you know, they're all waiting for this thing. And so along comes June 2013. And subsequent to that, there are a series of meteors. And so Courtney Brown comes out and says, oh, our study was correct. But what happened is that the global coastal event occurred in an adjacent timeline. That is, in a different dimension. Because what happened is that on December 21st, 2012, Dr. Carl Joseph Kalaman would say October 28th, 2011, because he calculated according to different figures in the month. In the Mayan calendar, at the main portal at the core of our universe started broadcasting permanently waves of unity consciousness, which is we are one, not duality consciousness, which is I win, you lose, which is how you create catastrophic timelines. In other words, Tulloch, I think you were the one that really suggested this model to me, that if you look at the time-space hologram that we're in, it's composed of multiple timelines. That's an evidentiary finding that we know from Project Pegasus. We are inside an artificial construct, which is a time-space hologram. Yes. That's what we incarnate into as souls. And that hologram is composed of multiple parallel timelines that are like parallel lanes on a superhighway, and some are more catastrophic than others. This is almost like a virtual reality, like a carnival e-ride, you know? And so collectively, we can shift, say we can change lanes from a more catastrophic to a less catastrophic reality. So that is what occurred on December 21st, 2012. Now, so that the formula, however, if you take into account what scholars like Dr. Carl Johan Kalaman talk about, it's not only the objective dimension of time, which is the component of the time-space hologram, it's also the waves of unity consciousness that are being broadcast into a particular universe through the singularity at the portal, at the core, through the core singularity at the entrance to the universe, and then mediated through the singularity or black holes at the core of each of the galaxies, and then mediated through the singularities at the core of each of our solar systems, which are the suns. We know that from Nassim Haramein's work.
Right.
And so our minds, our brains, the more that they're tuned in to these waves of unity consciousness, then the more that we can take advantage of these shifts in the timeline and evolve and grow with unity consciousness of we are one, and enjoy and create a positive future. Because the formula that we came to was positive future equals positive timeline, in other words, the timeline that we shifted onto, plus unity consciousness, which is that formula that we know from the Mayan calendar. Because the Mayan calendar is not only a map of time, but it's a map of consciousness. So those are some of the factors which occur for the data that Simon is really talking about. The shift, it's actually an objective force, which is the timeline, and then it's a subjective force in the sense that each human, depending on their capacity, can tune into this new morphic field of unity consciousness. It's, you know, to the extent that you can. Those who meditate and who can really are open to receiving those new waves can. So there's a 15-page paper at positivefuture.info. Scoop in New Zealand published it and put it on the world news a couple of weeks ago. So it's really kind of like a meme that's out there now. So I'm kind of promoting it, you know. Mm-hmm. No matter where you plug it in, it seems to work, either in an ET context, in a political context. It's a formula that is like a force multiplier in whatever activity or whatever arena you're doing. And in the realm of ET contact, it explains, that equation explains the dynamics of how our rather dense three-third density minds can open up to receive ET contact.
Yeah, you know, following up on that, Alfred, I just want to put this out there to, I guess, JD's next up, but I just want to kind of put this out there and maybe get his take on it. But Simon had mentioned the year 2016, which I, as I meditate, I'm getting that year as well as a major change, just me personally through my meditation and the work that I do. But of course, we have to be careful with, you know, predictions, even with us saying tonight, like, OK, we're kind of predicting what impact would open contact have, ET contact have on the populace. And so there are so many variables that will have an influence on a particular day and time, the way we perceive it in such a linear way. From these higher vantage points, from, say, fifth density and above, I'm aware that the beings that I communicate with don't see time, well, first of all, at all, because everything's happening in the present moment of now to them. So it's hard for them to even really put it out there, a particular date. And so there have been people that predicted various things, such as Tolek over the years there. He predicted a lot of things that, as far as these underground bases that would get destroyed on a particular day or time and a location, and it was amazing to me. But there's also, you know, pitfalls in it too, of saying, hey, this is going to happen on this particular day. And so I know, because I get letters about this all the time, that I got to put it out there to everybody on the line. What do we say to those naysayers that are saying, oh, yeah, here we go again. First it was the Y2K in 2000, then it was going to be the 2012 thing. And where's the tangible evidence is what everybody's going to be asking after we're done with this call. So I'm going to go with JD first, and then Tolek or Simon, whoever wants to follow up with that.
Okay, well,
That's a triple Hakajimi you just threw at me. Well,
you can handle it, big guy.
I can. I've done quadruples before. Only a couple times. Anyhow, seriously, folks, these are very important things that you all have said, and there are some real gems that I heard from each of you that I'm building into my response. Alfred was talking about expanded consciousness and a group consciousness and a future, a positive future, where our collective consciousness is able to mold that. So that implies a group telepathy, a group understanding of what each other is thinking, which is an important element of a common ground in the cases of abductees and contactees, that the extraterrestrials talk to them telepathically. And with some contactees that I've talked to, part of their early situation in the contact was their fear that the extraterrestrials were probing them and judging them spiritually, or knew that they stole the candy bar from Sister Mary's desk in the fifth grade, whatever. That the telepathic dialogue was able to go beyond the beta wave dialogue into the deeper areas of consciousness of themselves, and they felt very ashamed, very guarded about all that. And it was an interesting element to put together when I was building a hypothesis of what are the extraterrestrials like, why do they come here? In my work of signal processing and audio and video and imagery and simulation and all that, comes other scientific situations, other projects that we're involved with might involve other things, such as heuristic and human factors modeling. It would be interesting if I took one of the tests that are used for someone to analyze their own behavior and their colleagues and fellow employees to analyze them, where there's a few hundred questions that are given of, you like to watch grandma, 5 degrees of strongly dislike to mildly dislike, like very much, eureka, 5 grades. Or what would you rather do, paint a house or wash the dog? And by the quantifying of these different questions, you're able to then get a push one button and the computer will calculate the personality that you have. So if you fill it out for yourself, you get one profile of what you believe your overall characteristics, your personality is, and other people fill it out, asking the same questions about you, then there may be a totally different perspective. Well, what if we went to James Harder and the files of Leonard Stringfield and Robin Quayle, people that had been interviewing abductees, hypnotic regression, asking questions, and lift out the personality traits so that we could describe that to the data model that we were doing and get a printout of the personality and predictive character traits of the extraterrestrials. Don't be fooled by the simplicity with which that rolled off my lips, okay? There was a lot to do to make that project happen. It took a few years. But one of the key things was we have, Other than the crime that they commit of kidnapping, which is abduction, kidnapping is against the law on this planet, as you know, Dr. Weber. I consider a lawyer, a JD, to be a doctor, by the way. I call friends of mine.
Yeah, right. It is. And here in Canada and at every place but the U.S., I'm called doctor. But in the U.S., no one's a prophet in their own hometown, right?
And Alfred, my friend, I enjoy calling you Dr. Webb. So, and as you know, that kidnapping is a felony punishable by life in prison. So you know, what would the reason be that extraterrestrials feel that they are allowed to commit such a crime when they are otherwise very benevolent, apparently benevolent? So my friend Frank Corey says they borrow us. Borrowing means you haven't taken them permanently, you're going to bring them back. So what would all that mean in a larger picture? Well, if extraterrestrials speak telepathically with humans always, does not that mean that they are telepathic with each other at all times? And wouldn't that not imply that the ability to commit a crime, make a mistake, lie, steal, not be able to properly have a important dialogue with a colleague because you don't have the strength of character, any of those flaws, that we as humans can analyze those by our free will and decide whether or not we want to ignore that or whether we want to improve ourselves to be able to not do that again in the future. It's a very important thing. Implying that extraterrestrials would then grow in consciousness only as a group. No one individual could break away, do something that was less than proper, sometimes called a crime, analyze it, improve themselves, and become better, separate of a larger group. We can do that. We can do that if we want to, as humans. And in studying some of the important data characteristics that repeat over and over and over and over again, the hypothesis that grew out of it all, including certain elements of religion, certain elements that are human nature, certain elements of extraterrestrial spacecraft hiding. They're here, they're there, they're gone, they're here, they're gone. You can see them, you can't, they're on right, they're hiding. For hiding. What would the grand unified purpose that they have be in order for us to understand that first in order to effectively have communication? And between humans, that's what you want to have, is effective communications, effective dialogue. I want to understand you, and I want you to understand me. And if I knew a little bit about you before we have our contact or dialogue, our exchange would be better. Hopefully, mission accomplished.
Well, well said, JD. Well said.
Thank you.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just agree wholeheartedly.
Well, I was wondering if that was not a good stop point, but now I think I do want to do one more paragraph to summarize it. It began to be clear to me after dealing with so many thousands, really, of photographs, and the personality of the people that photographed them, what was their experience of the investigators, the nature of the images, and the understanding of the beliefs. Many of the government labs that I work, so to say, in my day job, as we go as a contractor, or when I would go to a lab to do analysis of something for Wendell or for APRO, what are they like in there? What do they think about the extraterrestrial issue? And generally speaking, there's more naysayers, more mean-spirited people in the UFO field than I have encountered in government agencies. That being understood, we move to the point of having dialogue with extraterrestrials. What are the conditions that surround that, and what are their purposes? It seems to me that the extraterrestrials believe that we are potentially the most advanced species made yet, and that by our genetic makeup, and by my work in genomics and informatics in the genome project and visualization, I get to look at DNA down at the atomic level, which is really just a remarkable thing. But in our genetic makeup, we are able to do things that they are not able to do. They are not able to individually decide to do something that's a mistake, decide to analyze it and improve themselves and grow intellectually, spiritually, creatively. And that makes us very unique, very unique. One group polices us, keeping us safe, allowing us to go with our own free will whenever fate and destiny present themselves. And the extraterrestrials that want to understand that about us are communicating passively. It's not interactive. They're observing, they're telepathic, they knock the human out, erase their memories best they can, bring them back. And in that dialogue with humans, they are attempting to understand not our weapons, not our technology. If they feel bad that we can't manage it and that we've run amok around all that, but they're not trying to analyze that or give us any, except on rare occasions. They're trying to understand, with all of our potential for great consciousness and intellectual, spiritual expansion, why we've suppressed ourselves. Why don't we let that out? Why don't we let that go? And what happens when the free will tool that we have, the free will ability that we have, is applied towards negative things, such as, you ever noticed in the newspaper every day that at least one guy killed another guy? Or sometimes hundreds of thousands of humans are killed with tremendous resources spent financially to create all of those, while the resources for medicine and agriculture and creative and stimulating affairs are minimal budgets. And they wonder about that. And they're trying to figure out if that element of free will, if reapplied back into their genetics or society, might be any good or not. And what's going to happen with us? What's going to happen with us as a species? And are we going to become our full potential? Are we going to blow ourselves up? And of all the hypotheses that could account for who they are and why they come here, what we need to understand before we collectively begin a dialogue, other than the few frontliners, the first responders, like Chris, like many that you, like Tulloch, like many that you have interviewed, like you, Simon, other than those first responders, collectively as a planet, when will that happen? And when it happens, do we understand what they want? And I believe that they are mystified as to what is the element, what is the thing that has blocked us and prevented us. And they keep coming from all over the universe to look at these poor little humans that have run amok. So that's the end of my speech. I hope I made a long story interesting.
Wow. This is Tulloch. JD, there's so much quality of information you brought to bear in this topic. And I'd like to make this a little more interactive, if I may, between myself, and not only in the group, but specifically myself and Simon, because our perspectives are unique in that we've been having both telepathic as well as spirit-based as well as physical contact with different species.
Yes.
And that makes our perspective a little different, maybe from the group, maybe from other people who are listening. In any case, I think part of the answer, and again, I want to make this piece at least more interactive, and Simon, jump in here. Yes. Whenever you have some knowledge you'd like to bring to bear.
Okay.
I think that some of the answers are inherent in that, and I hate using this word, but for the epic, if you will, and that's not the word I hate, it's time. For the epoch of time that humanity on this planet has evolved, much like each of the planets in the solar system and each of the solar systems and each of the galaxies have their own evolutionary blueprint on timeline, I believe it is our time to our being the human race on this planet and other species in the solar system. Because there are other life forms, at least based on what I've learned, there are other life forms in the solar system that live here that are of a higher vibratory rate than we are in this lower organic dense 3D. That it is, if you will, the time for this planet and the species on this planet to raise in frequency, to evolve. And I believe that one of the reasons that we've not evolved to our greatest potential until this time is likely due to the significant interference on the part of the Draco and Hydra reptilians, those reptilians that are also from the Sirius B system, as well as those that are working in collaboration with the great-grandchildren of what people call the Greys, the little guys from Zeta Reticuli, there has been decided malevolent interference and manipulation of the human race on this planet. And whether you call them meat-eating reptilians or you call them Anunnaki, based on a lot of allegorical stories, empirical evidence, writings on the walls of pyramids, there's obvious intervention on the part of what people in the old times would call gods, which are simply either more advanced technologically and or higher density beings that have, for the most part, seen us on this planet as a great natural resource. And if we as organic human beings are, that our consciousness is elevating, that we're becoming more aware, that we are in fact soul inhabiting a human organic body which has a short-term lifespan, if we are in fact evolving and we're able to evolve, then one of the groups of beings that's certainly curious in that process is what have been aggressive, natural resource-taking reptilians. And I'm trying to use words that are the least aggressive as possible, but Simon, I really would like to hear your thoughts and feedback on this topic in terms of where this issue is today, maybe what insight that you've been able to garner, and maybe some alternative paths for humanity on this planet, because we could go on thinking that it's just us in this beautiful blue, you know, beautiful little blue water-filled world, and in surprise, surprise, there are galaxies and universes full of people, and guess what? They don't all look humanoid. They look reptilian. They look mantid. There's just an incredible, based on what I've learned, there's an incredible variety of species out there. I met one guy who I quite wasn't ready for, and I called him Slimy Worm Guy. For people that are familiar with Star Wars, as an example, the best analogy I can give you is a being that I met that looked just like the character of the Star Wars science fiction movies known as Jabba the Hutt. This guy was a dead ringer for Jabba the Hutt, but he was about one-third the size. And as I was being introduced to people, they introduced me to him, and I went, whoa, get me out of here. And you know, I had been exposed to already, at that time, 10 or 11 races at least of of beings that were either humanoid or somewhat humanoid. So even me, who'd been out there and meeting people on different planets and different worlds, I saw a slimy worm guy. I freaked. My Andromeda Council contacts thought that was funny. They were having a good laugh at my expense. But I want to get back to my point. Simon, your thoughts, observations on where the human race can evolve to, and do you think it's possible for us to evolve in concert with a race that's inflamed us, manipulated us, and abused us?
Okay.
And I'll close my mouth at this point.
Okay, well, before I do that, I'm going to first of all pick up what Andrew Weber has talked about there, Dr. Weber. Then I'm going to deal with what JD said, because JD's points there are questions for all of humanity. And there is some fear in there, and we'll want to deal with that. And then, Tolik, I'd like to bring up the points that you've made. Before I start, I suppose I should make it clear that my body is relatively human, but my soul is composed of one-third Mantid, one-third Draco, and one-third Hollow Earth human. It has to be that way because I have to be in balance. And the human and the Mantid always outvote the Draco. So that'll give you some idea of where I'm coming from. Okie doke. First of all, Alfred, you talked about unity consciousness, and I agree with you 100%. The only thing missing there is that it doesn't work unless there are creatures on the planet that can interact and interface with unity consciousness to actually change the timeline for the better. And I'd like to give you some examples of that, Alfred. And approaching the 21st of December 2012, the Hadron Collider, a device that you will be very well familiar with, was designed to have a detrimental effect upon the consciousness change that was scheduled for humanity. You will know from your own research that the machine was deactivated a day just before it was supposed to operate. It was supposed to operate right over the Christmas period and peak on the 21st of December. That machine developed a fault inside one of the tubes, which took 6 hours to get to and a further 6 hours to repair. By the time that device was repaired, the peak for the 2012 had actually occurred. The device did not operate. I want to give you another example, Alfred. On the 30th of September last year, the National Security Agency's new base at Bluffdale, which is the device that stores all of the emails, all of the Skype calls, all of the phone calls, was the day that the ribbon cutting ceremony was going to occur and all the dignitaries were informed. They had a power outage. It shut down the whole of the organization, and all the people who were on their way to cut the ribbon had to be cancelled. This is how unity consciousness, working with a small group of people all over the planet, send messages to government and change timelines. So it is unity consciousness, you're absolutely right, but there have to be those creatures on the planet who can link with that and make changes. Okay, that's the first point I wanted to make. Now I want to talk about JD. JD, your points are absolutely germane to the topic here. And although you raised those points, you didn't actually develop them, and I'd like to just take a little time, because after this I'm going to have to go, guys. Now then, when we talk about aliens, we keep forgetting, I think, that there are many different sorts of aliens. There are those that actually don't give a damn about what happens to humanity. There are those that are very, very interested and want the best outcome. And there are those that really don't want to change the status quo. And they are hive-minded. And there are many groups of aliens who are working together for a negative purpose, as there are many groups that are working for a positive purpose. The ones that are negative remain hidden because they do not want to be seen. The ones that are positive remain hidden because they do not want to force the timeline, because it's not the right time yet. And so both groups are interacting with individuals. You'll find that the negative the negative aliens are interacting with governments much more than the positive group. And the question is, can we trust them? Well, which group? We don't know yet which group is going to actually open a full dialogue. And so these are the serious questions that JD has put forward from a not just a human standpoint, but from any standpoint of a technologically inferior race, but not a spiritually inferior race. The human race is absolutely wonderful, and if it's allowed to survive, will become one of the most beautiful creations in the multiverse. Humans create. Most aliens cannot create. They've lost it. You're absolutely right. And that's why alien souls wish and do incarnate into human bodies so that they can experience. My own soul has been taken from my body with my permission and placed in an alien body, and I have undertaken tasks, and we've done like a holiday swap. And of course that's pretty far out for most people, but that's the reality of the situation. I want to talk about Tolek. Tolek, there are some experiments now taking place all over the planet in small families, human type families, where what I call higher humans, so you call them Andromedans, I would call them Lyrans, Palladians, the higher rank of the Syrians, where those in a family are interacting with another human-based creature with a reptilian soul to see if they can live together and get on together. And there are two experiments taking place in Canada at the moment. So that might be interesting for you. Mm-hmm. I coordinate many of these experiments, and I support these individuals as they go through trials and tribulations, attempting to see if they can find balance. The Dracos, the white reptilians, certainly don't really want change. They are stuck in their ritual of ceremony, and they feel that they are the gods, and therefore we should treat them as gods. But you know what? The big ship is sinking. And some of these Dracos now are looking at the lifeboats, and they're wondering now, should we jump ship, get on a lifeboat, and start opening a dialogue? And just before I close, I would say that I attended a BASIS conference run by a good friend of mine called Miles Johnson, and he asked me to speak at his conference in Marlborough in Great Britain. And I was contacted by an intermediary from a very powerful organization who offered me bodyguards, armored cars, and a deep underground base to go to if I needed it, at no cost. Well, I'm not overly keen on the deep underground base, but I think it'd be rather cool one day to turn up to my town hall when there's a big meeting on and to get out of a fleet of blacked out armored cars with bodyguards. What I'm saying here is that as 2016 approaches, there will be a lot of games being played. If we can get through 2016, Alfred's absolutely right, and others are right. 2017 is the point that we will have level playing field. And back to Tolek's point, in 2017, the human race will make a choice because the level playing field will allow it to have enough information to make that choice. And its consciousness will decide whether it wants to play a game with a greater multiverse and advance, or whether it's quite happy to stay in the gutter where it is now, held down by a very small, uncaring group of creatures that have been here since Sumerian times and before.
Right.
And we really have to say to people who don't believe us, are not interested, it is your choice. If you cannot make the choice by the time of 2016, then you will be a group of humans who will have self-excluded themselves. That is the reality, what will happen. Because those who are becoming spiritual, those who are changing, they will be the ones who will cope with interaction. Those who have closed hearts and closed minds will not be able mentally to take the situation as it changes. And so through what I would call, make a joke of Charles Darwin's natural selection, through natural selection, the consciousness will actually have creatures on the planet that will be able to develop and change. And the creatures that can't develop and change will just naturally die off. So I'm very positive about the future. I'm just concerned that some of the small noises that negative people, negative creatures are making, shouldn't be allowed to be blown up out of all proportion. I'm going to close by saying I'm really hopeful for the future. Listen, thanks ever so much for having me on. It's a great pleasure. I love all of you. You're all doing a tremendously great job. And, let's keep in touch. So thank you very much for having me.
Simon?
Thank you, Simon.
May I share a thought with you before you go?
Sure.
This is Tolik. First off, I wanted to make sure, I think you probably understood the inference, but I want to say it plainly. Because for me in life, one of the most important things is clarity of communication. And so what I'm about to say is as clear as I can be. I was not at all trying to be accusatory in my statement, but rather seeking to satisfy internal curiosity on my part about your views and how you see us moving forward and what kind of interaction can we have with certainly the different extraterrestrial races as we move forward and evolve on this planet. And I just wanted to make sure that you understood that was not accusatory, but rather curiosity on my part.
Oh, it's absolutely fine. It's okay. It's just there's so much information to get out, and we only ever have such a short time on this 3D reality, of course, because it's getting shorter and shorter for us.
Yes.
Aware of that. It's just simply that there are huge questions. JD's actually, I think, done a fantastic job tonight because he's spoken from the heart. He's actually put across the feelings that many people have but can't articulate, and a lot of them are scientists working in close proximity to alien creatures, probably more like the robotic types. And they are very fearful. I have been in an underground base where I have seen scientists actually mentally break down. I have seen a situation where a scientist was teaching a group of hybrid human alien creatures how to use a coffee percolator, because they need to be able to learn how to operate domestic equipment if they're going to integrate properly. And he just had a mental breakdown and started shouting at them. And the creatures sent a mental telepathic message to the two reptilian bodyguards, which went along the lines of, help, 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 we fear for our physical bodies. The reptilian physically ran across the room, grabbed the scientist by the neck, and lifted him off the floor, and would have ripped his head off had it not interceded very quickly. Many, many humans who work in these bases are on drugs to maintain their equilibrium. And if the public actually knew just how in depth the government is enmeshed in negative agenda, I think they would be quite disgusted. And I would come back to my beginning point, which was, for those in government who wish to jump ship, they should receive a piece of paper which says they are exempt from prosecution, because we are going to need as many decent, knowledgeable people in the years to come, much more than we have in the past. And I would much rather have people who atone for their mistakes and are prepared to work for the good. I'd rather have them now, 1 minute to midnight, when it's very obvious what's going to happen and suddenly everybody wants to be your friend. So I am really positive about the future. And, you know, I think each one of you has been doing a fantastic job. I do watch you when I can. And I was delighted to be asked to speak with you. And I did enjoy that. I'd have to say that poor old Edgar was very uncomfortable. He was asked twice what he had seen as an astronaut. And, you know, somebody in his position cannot afford to tell you the truth. he cannot tell you, yes, actually, I personally have seen that, because he won't be around tomorrow, guys. So what he has to say is, well, I heard this, or my best friend saw this, or I read this. But what we have to do is read between the lines and say, when he says my best friend saw this, that actually means he saw it. My grandfather worked for CIA, my mother worked for NSA through the British intelligence, and I came up through an espionage family, and poor old Ed Gee was very uncomfortable. So it's just as an aside, guys, the next time we have someone like that, it'd probably be a good idea not to ask them a direct question, because they find it very hard. Anyway, listen, that's brilliant. Thanks ever so much. God bless you all, and I'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you for your contribution, okay. Simon.
That's fine. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, Simon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, Alfred. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, guys, we're down to, let's see, we got Alfred, we got JD, and we got Tolik. And so does anybody else have to leave now, or do we still have a little bit of time left? Alfred?
Yeah, no, I'm fine with time.
Okay, JD?
Yes, I'm fine for another 20 minutes until just after 2.
Okay, so that sounds good. Tolik?
Yeah, me too. I think that's about right. I'd like to share a story, if I may. I was with a gentleman, JD, who you know, by the name of Dan Brock, and we were in Wilmot Library for a meeting, and it was a meeting that had about 15 or 20 people. It was not a MUFON meeting. It was not any other kind of UFO or ET kind of meeting. It was a meeting about raising consciousness. And the meeting took place, I want to say, November of 2012. It took place on a Saturday morning. In any case, there were probably about 15 or 20 people there. And here's the point of the story. As we walked in, I think there were about 12 people or so that were sitting in these chairs that were in essentially a circle. Maybe there were 13 or 14 people, but Dan and I walked in and sat down on the opposite side of the circle. And I happened to look up after I sat down, and I saw this man who was tall compared to me. He was probably 6'2", large shoulders, kind of large chested, and he had a large forehead, which was extended a little bit at an angle outward, almost like he had ridges. To make a long story short, there was considerable energy that was going back and forth between he and I, and this energy wasn't pleasant. And as each of us were telling our own unique stories, and we were sharing, I told my story, and it went around to the next 6 or 7 people, and then this gentleman told his story, and he looked up at me and he said, "Tolik, you and others are doing work to help people understand the growth that is necessary to become a higher dimensional human." He then proceeded to say, "My soul is not a human soul, it is a reptilian soul. And I'm here to tell you, I'm down here working in the trenches, and we're working with people 3D and below." He said, "I will tell you that it is difficult for me and others to understand that there can be light, to understand that there can be love in our lives. Even as a reptilian, it's been a challenge for me to open up, to open my heart to others. And it's happened very, very slowly." He said, "And it's the first time in a long, long time that any of us of reptilian origin are choosing to explore, choosing to examine the possibility of change, choosing to possibly let a little bit of light in, and maybe love a little. I was astounded. I had never heard anyone, nobody had ever said that to me before. And I won't say that he was angry at all, but I could definitely sense from an energy perspective that his energy was cold, for lack of a better word, and at minimum aggressive. And yet he was very tempered when he said to me what he said. Very, very interesting experience. Now keep in mind that was November of 12, roughly. And I just thought I would share that story in connection with some of the things that Simon said just recently.
I'd like to ask everyone on the panel, because this is one of the first times that I've come across the distinction. I just spent a lot of time studying the whole intelligent civilization of souls. If you go into the literature on the parapsychological side, they don't make distinctions between human souls, reptilian souls, and getting into the exophenotypology of extraterrestrials, you know, such that there would be feline souls, gray souls, etc. And this seems to be to say that, oh, there's a different soul type for the exophenotypology. And rather, what I've discovered through trying to integrate the parapsychology, you know, how souls incarnate into the multiverse and into bodies, is that, yes, I'll spend time as a reptilian. I'll spend time, you know, we our souls take on a variety of different incarnations. And this is the first time that I've come across. I know that Simon said, oh, I'm one-third mantid. My soul is one-third mantid, one-third Draco, and one-third human. That's even coming down to a specific origin of soul, of reptilian soul. So have people heard that before? Or could it be something, you know, not soul, but some intermediate body? I'm kind of turning it over to the panel.
Yeah, if I could jump in on this, Alfred.
Yeah.
My perspective is this, is that a lot of times people associate themselves early on in the wake-up period, so to speak, of who their last and higher incarnation was as a higher being. And mm-hmm. so whenever I went through this process, I associated myself early on as a Syrian light warrior initially. And then as I became more and more aware of me being simply a soul that has incarnated in many different incarnations, whether it be Syrian, Mantis, my most recent awareness is the Arcturian. And each one of them has different dimensional awarenesses. And so because of we're human beings and we separate everything for the purpose of an experience, it's also separate that dimensions are separate and what roles apply within this dimension. Okay, what roles apply that make you a Syrian? What roles apply? And so all this separation is for the purpose, in my opinion, of a particular experience. And so I'm in alignment with what you're saying. I don't particularly agree that there are individual souls that are created in a particular place. I think it's more of a recognition of that part of yourself from that place. That's my personal opinion, right. And that's where I've come to with my evolutionary or my ascension process.
Very good.
And so I would like to maybe Tolik, you could come in on this, because I know you just mentioned on the panel that your soul has come from somewhere else. And I'm wondering if you meant that it was actually from there, or if that's your association with your higher self that you're currently consciously aware of at this particular moment of now?
I'll tell you what I've learned. And of course, up until this moment in time, I have learned much information. I've learned a lot about what's happened down the universe and its evolution here on this planet. I've learned a lot about myself. Hopefully, I will continue to learn. So now I'll answer the question based on what I know to date about my own soul's evolution. I've learned that the first place that I had life experiences where I, if you will, was a child, where I grew up, where I met, where I went to school, where I met young women, that was on the planet Dakota, which is in the Taygeta star system, which is in the open star cluster of the Pleiades. Now, separate and aside from that, I was having a conversation with the commander of the Primary Andromeda Council Biosphere, and we were talking about my work as an upper fourth density becoming mid fifth density human. And I said something about, well, sometime, and this is the problem when you have the topic of time that we happen to reference almost everything about on this planet. I said, you know, sometime in the future when I become a 6D person or 7D. And he said, well, you already have been. You've already worked as a 6D person. I went, And so these are, at least for me, these are difficult concepts to get my head around because I am 3D. I am 4D. It's more likely that I'm a upper fourth, lower to mid fifth soul operating this human organic body. And when this body dies, I'll either have another body or I'll choose to do something else. But I've learned that at some point in this soul's experience, and from what I understand, the life of the soul is almost limitless. At least on the planet Dakota, you go to around, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 years as we would measure time. And then we say to ourselves, okay, I've had this expansive amount of, again, wrong word, but I've had this expansive amount of time with all these different experiences as a 4D person or as a 5D, and I really want to become a 6D person. So I simply choose to do that. And what the commander of the biosphere was saying is, you've chosen to do that already. You've already functioned as a 60 person. It's a difficult concept to talk about because from what I'm learning, time is only relevant to the fact that the human organic body has a lifespan of X number of years. And because of this planet's proximity to the sun and a few other factors, it grows old quick. But the human body is not the human being. The human body is not, the human body is not the soul, is not the person.
Yeah, you know, Tolik, I just want to jump in real quick with what you just said.
Sure.
And it's where I've come to in my awareness is that we are multidimensional beings. We have an aspect of ourselves on every dimension, and we have lived out, because you're mentioning time, so everything really happens in the present moment, like right now. And so where you focus your attention is where your experience lies. And so what they're telling you is that you've already lived out a sixth dimensional, yes, and you are living out. And so we talk about timelines just for the purpose of discussion, so we can understand and have some semblance of understanding, so that we can sit here and have a communication between one another, and not just ourselves, but other people that aren't at our current level of awareness. And right. So this is all about communication. And so if you realize that we are a multidimensional being, which what does that mean? Well, that means there's an aspect of me that is a Sirian light warrior that is existing in this present moment of now, but my focus is right here, right now, Joe Mara, on this radio show. And so as we drop body, so to speak, then we become much more aware of that multidimensional being that we truly are. And I really think that we're just a fractal of the God source, so to speak. And well, so this is where all that ancient geometry comes into play. But I think the difficulty and the hang-up comes when we're trying to communicate and articulate this awareness that we currently have at a present moment. And so, and the confusion is also that everybody has a different perspective at a given time. And so if I was to look back and rewind like 5 years ago, I wouldn't be able to talk at this level because I wouldn't understand even what is going on. And I had to go through my own growth and my own experiences and my own awareness to be able to articulate, I understand exactly what you're going through and where you're talking about because I've been there. And so, you know, what does it mean? The whole discussion tonight is about, you know, how would open ET contact impact humanity? Well, all of this is going to come out on the table for people to ponder, to understand, to come to the realization that we're not these meat bodies and that's it. All of the scientific evidence that's out there that says that we're only using 8 to 10% of our brain and 3 to 5% of our DNA, what happens when we turn that all on and turn it all up? What kind of a magnificent, magical co-creator of this unified field could we be? And so the variables I was talking about before about, you know, trying to predict what will happen when, one of the variables are we have our own individual focus, but we also are connected to the unified field of humanity and the planet, the solar system, and all these other things. And so depending on what we're tuned into or turn our channel or our focus towards, that dictates our particular experience in that present moment. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is it's really difficult to articulate some of these experiences, these knowings, these awarenesses, to generalize it because it depends on where you are in your awareness, each individual person. Right. And so with that, I'm just going to leave it to JD or Alfred to come in.
Well, I'd like for JD, if you could, Jim, Simon, you seem to have struck a particular note with Simon of your your insights, and I don't think I quite caught your insights. And if you could frame them or, you know, state them again, because I think I actually may have missed something there.
Okay. Well, there was a big lead up, so to say, of the circumstances that I was in that led me to a hypothesis, but I'll go right to the hypothesis now. Of the best case scenario that includes so many of the factors that exist in our observation of the extraterrestrial presence, abductions, contacts, and our antecedents, our history in various religions and sightings throughout even ancient times. So the grand unified theory that all those things fit into is that, one, there isn't a government cover-up. So there is an extraterrestrial cover-up because the government people that maybe are at the top of the food chain who know that if it was disclosed, the extraterrestrials would still be a no-show.
Yeah.
Their behavior that they don't come, they don't reveal themselves, which leads into why? What are their purposes for being here? I would see that there is one group of extraterrestrials that looks like us, that right. precedes us, that we are somehow part of the cloning process that brought some elements of distant consciousness into that Adam's rib and this species of humans was created, or other techniques. And that this species of human is perhaps the most advanced one that exists, that's been created in many universes. We have the potential for great intellect, creativity, consciousness expansion based on free will. We have free will. They have telepathy. Extraterrestrials are a group consciousness if they all have telepathy, in that the potential for an individual to make mistakes, analyze the mistakes, improve oneself, and grow is not available to someone that's in an extraterrestrial group consciousness. And they are coming here from various places to study the current situation of humans that have all this potential, but are normal go-to-work people every day on one hand. And on the other hand, it's people that have, by some light or transmission, shines out that they are a bit more conscious or more advanced than the average bear, than the average human. So there's two kinds of humans that are, quote, abducted or contacted. One, the normal person, that is the average mean human, goes to work, has a family, and is abducted, and they're studied so that they can telepathically probe them, understand their thoughts, their feelings as best they can, what motivates them to lead or follow, and also some physical examination sometimes that they're trying to understand our immune system so that they can be prepared to be here longer. Perhaps that's why the feces extraction happens in some other tests. But that they are curious or driven to understand why an advanced species like us that's been, quote, genetically engineered, infused with consciousness, intellect, emotional potential, physical prowess, and we have, as a species, allowed a small number, always, to control the masses into a warlike state based on emotions of, I want what they have. I'm going to take that. And where is the potential going in this cycle of humanity, and one group that looks like us protects us from others, maybe even protects us from ourselves, but generally allows us the free will to continue, and our fate and destiny as presented to us is modified by our free will. Maybe Y2K was really going to happen only by collective consciousness did it not happen. I think that there's a 50-50 chance, or maybe better than 50-50, that it was collective consciousness that changed that fate.
Yeah.
It was fated to come up, but not destined to happen.
Yeah. Right. It was that same formula. We're getting kind of some feedback, but it was that same equation of positive timeline plus unity consciousness. The only comment, Jim, that I would make is when you use extraterrestrials can or cannot do these things, I think that you're talking about one particular exophenotype of extraterrestrials. And that is the one species of grays that is engaged in the abduction program under its treaty with the United States, because they are the ones that are doing the abducting, and they have a particular exophenotype. I think that they're the,
yes,
you know, kind of the medium grays, or the maybe the small grays. And because right now there are over 150 known species of grays alone.
Yes.
And what the we are sort of the our exophenotype, that is the human exophenotype, which is fairly common in our universe, is actually the intelligent mammalian. Not mammalian, the intelligent primate. And, and the Dracos are the intelligent reptilian. And in some sense, the Greys you can think of as intelligent plants. That is, they are how plant life, how vegetable life looks like when intelligence takes on vegetable form. And we get that from an extraterrestrial project that entered into dialogue with them. And they talk about how important chlorophyll is to them,
right,
that they take on their ships and all of that.
Yeah.
Good.
That's an outstanding input into and new for me. Thank you for that element. Because as I said, I gathered so many different people's concepts and data to create a unified theory concept that I keep adding to, because I kind of like travels with Gurdjieff. I'm hunting around looking for things that kind of contribute to an epiphany. And special circumstances that exist, like with the Greys, have become nailed down into the evolution of our planet. Meanwhile, from other places in the universe where they come to visit, I do believe that we are, at our DNA level, more advanced, with more potential, than many or most of the visiting extraterrestrials. They've just applied what they have, where we have not. And only by the small changes that happen one person at a time, Alfred, all it takes is one person a week for you to influence in your show to cascade the butterfly effect. Tolik, the same thing. And Dr. Joe, in the medical practice that you do, while you've got your hands in their body, they are receiving, are they not, a transfer of your consciousness also? The ways that we help each other as humans is what they are most interested in. How is the human race advancing itself? Television is a big tool, doesn't seem to be working. It's ads and shoot 'em up. So the keys to the kingdom appear to be, in the things that we're all talking about, an expansion of consciousness. Isn't that the real goal? If we all knew tomorrow, for a fact, everyone, that extraterrestrials come here, then what? Do we want to learn how to dance, play their music? Or do we get back to the business of the optimization of the human and our soul potential? So maybe we just pretend that everybody knows extraterrestrials come here, and we accelerate the tools for the development of the human. Mate, as I said, these are all maybes, because I still have to wear that scientist hat versus the musician hat. But it's only by going to smart people like you guys that I'm able to gather things that fit, that's then what I follow. Even though I'm putting together a science metaphor and a science hypothesis, in the end, it still comes down to people that I know, that I look them in the eye and ask them what they think is happening. And I'll just close with this one example. I was a guest of Chris and a few others in Tucson a couple years ago, and I was speaking on whatever the topic was, and I decided at the end that that's not what I wanted to be at the front of the room for. Because I saw who was out there in the audience, and it was all these capable, smart people, investigators, contactees. So I apologize for stopping my speech, but I turned my control of the podium over to, I wanted to ask them questions.
Brilliant. That was brilliant.
What they thought. Because I was not academically collecting the data, but I wanted to know for myself, for my family. I wanted to know if they thought that 12-12, etc., Mayan calendar, end of the world was going to happen or not? Should I be getting ready? What did they think? And everyone in the room, including Chris, said, no, nothing. It's great to talk about, but consciousness has changed it. And the honor that I had was being able to ask questions for whatever it was, the next 30 minutes, about what they thought, what, because I'm just a regular guy. I want to know what other people that have been out there in the trenches, finding out from the many others that are out there, witnesses and experiencers, what you come to believe. Because when I don't know something and how I should integrate it, I'm going to go to Tolik and Joe and Alfred and ask them how they feel about something that I don't really know about yet. And I need to know. I want to know more. So I don't know if you remember that, Chris, that event.
I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. And and you know, you bring up a really good point. It's one of the reasons, at least for me, why these days I'm asking more questions than I am teaching, sharing what I know, because I've shared a lot of what I know and what I've learned. Timelines are what they are. Things have happened. Some things haven't. I believe that some things still will, but I'm only one person. Like I was trying to use a metaphor earlier, I'm just one piece of the puzzle. And all of you guys have all of your experiences that you individually experience and what you learn from others. And as we all reach out and talk to others, you know, like Simon, his is an amazing story.
Yes.
And I was astounded that a man who had his and who has his bloodline connection and who's told the story that he tells is still walking around in his body on this planet, and nobody's taken him out yet.
and who's a successful elected politician.
Exactly.
Where does he live again? Can we move there?
He's a counselor in a city in the UK.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, in England. But I think, what did JD, what they used to call it? Oblige noblesse. And I'll use a modern connotation. I think that, I can't speak for others, but I think for me, it's valuable that in the role that I play, that I help, I teach, I educate to the best of my ability. But it's also equally important for me to be asking the kind of questions like, okay, somebody from Aldebaran or somebody from Era in the Pleiades or somebody from Dakota or any one of the Andromeda Council planet members come down here and say, all right, you guys have evolved enough. We're here. What do you want to know? You know, there was so much that we weren't able to address today. And so many questions are going to stay unanswered until people of the Andromeda Council and or other ETs start to interact on an open basis with the people of planet Earth. And I will echo what Simon said, which is, it is highly likely that when we start to see open contact with ETs among people, this is just my belief, that those ETs, whether they are 3D organic or whether they are 4D, 5D, that are manifesting organic bodies so they can interact with us, that those are likely the benevolent ETs because they're interacting with we the people on this planet, the people who live here, the people who are doing our best to eke out a day-to-day existence. You know, we are not the powers that be. We don't have limos. We don't have bodyguards. We are not in control of the Earth. We're the people trying to evolve. And I think that for people who are interested in watching how this all unfolds, I would recommend that they watch and pay attention to when ET contact starts, which ETs are saying what, who are they talking to, and be very careful of the benevolent ETs that are making promises to humanity to deliver certain things. Watch out for those guys.
Good. Joe, as host, do you want to wrap things up or?
Yes, but let me do one thing. I just want to respond to that. This one experience, as most people know, Terry, my friend Ippoletti, is a really deep channel. And one time we were channeling the reptilians, and it was by virtue of me calling upon Nibiru and or the Anunnaki or the gods that have planted seeds here. And so when we reached out to this what I believed was a reptilian at the time, it came back to speak to me. And through my friend Terry, the concept was this. They looked at humans the way we look at insects. And so I thought to myself, wow, okay, how do typically people look at insects as they're walking down the street? Do they actually avoid an ant? Or do they not even know that it's even there because they're not focused on them being there and what they do in their day-to-day life? And so some of these ETs that we're talking about have no idea that we're even in existence because we don't resonate with the same frequency, and therefore they can't perceive us. And so with all of my experience and all the channeling and all the other stuff that I've done with my life, I've realized that some of the things that was brought up as concepts tonight are so very true that – When will they connect with us? And first of all, when and who? Who will be connecting with us? Those that can even reach our vibration. Some of these higher vibrational beings won't come down because it's so dense and thick that it's not comfortable to come here. And the other factor is that they don't even know we exist because we're so low of a frequency. And so I think that it was important to put that out there, and also to know that not just humans are evolving on this planet at this time, but even the reptilians and the Dracos and some of the other what is perceived as the low vibrational or the negative people or beings, they are also evolving, and some of them have come through to discuss with us that very thing. That, you know, it's not all reptilians are bad. It's just because we live in a polarity of hot, cold, good, bad, up, down. And so everybody has that opportunity, that potential at this particular moment of now to raise in vibration. And so I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, it may be possible for everybody and everything to raise in vibration and ascend and to look to the possibility that not every species, not every one individual in that species is bad, per se. So I'm just going to leave it at that. And so I guess I'm going to close with thanking everybody for being on the show. You know, Dr. Mitchell, Simon Parks, Dr. Weber, which I think, Alfred, back in the day when we did the Universal Talk Radio show, I brought that out and I says, you know, why aren't we calling you doctor on the shows?
Well,
I don't know if
you
remember
thank
that.
You.
That was years ago whenever we did a show together. But I'm glad Jim brought that up because I definitely recognize it. I said, hey, JD is doctor, and in my book, you're a doctor. So you deserve, you know, you went to school and reached your highest level of achievement, and you know, you're going to be doctor on my show.
Great.
Well, thanks very much. Well, and so, and I appreciate from all three of you your contribution to my advancement. I always like being in the company of people that know and have experienced what you all have, because it enriches my life. And then together, maybe we have collectively enriched the listeners' lives.
Yes, yes. And thank you, JD. I hear an awful lot about you, and I interact with your fellow band members.
Oh yeah, right.
And also, I would like to give a note of appreciation to Tolik and to Joe for having initiated this series, which I think is going out on a high vibratory level itself and is raising the vibratory level of discourse in the entire field. So my kudos and appreciation go out to you on that note.
Well, thank you from Alfred. Right, I really appreciate that recognition and compliment. This is Tolik. And at least from my perspective, it's my hope that by bringing these topics out for open discourse and exploration, we can help to enlighten some people. I would hope that there are going to be some tidbits of knowledge and maybe wisdom that they gain from listening to whatever each of us has had to contribute in this conversation. And I feel honored to have partaken in it and being part of it. And you guys are all bright and accomplished in your own right. And Alfred, JD, thanks for joining Joe and I. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. JD, we have many years together, and lots of experiences, and it was a true pleasure to hear you share what you've learned over the course of years. It was certainly enlightening for me. So thanks for sharing what you shared.
All right, and I just have to, again, thank everybody, Dr. Mitchell, Simon Parks, Dr. Weber, Jim Della Toso, and Tolik for coming on the call. And again, I'm humbled to be in your presence, and I'm also in the positive timeline in my mind, and that's what I put forth, is I really think that humanity has made the turn, and it's just a matter of everybody coming online and realizing it. And so my contribution is simply to think positive as much as I can and help everybody raise their vibratory frequency, as Alfred and I have done actually a video one time, a YouTube, to raising your vibratory frequency back in the day. And I'd recommend those that wonder what that's all about to maybe go to YouTube and just Google, or like either Google it or YouTube it, and experience what we're talking about when we're talking about vibratory frequency, because your body will feel that vibratory frequency raise as you go through that meditation. And so that's my contribution, and love you guys. And you know what? Until next time, we're going to send you love, light, and laughter.
Don't forget it. As Frank Corey says, they will bring you back.
Damn.